Now, the relationship between today's shir and Parshas Mishpatim may not become apparent until sometime into the shir, and maybe even by the end of the shir. And this is another one of those things that I ask you, if you finally make it to the end of the shir, and you see absolutely no relationship between the sedra and the shir, somebody just raised their hand and say, Rabbi Goldman, so it was a terrific shir you gave today. But what does it have to do with Now, if you're not ready to say the first half of the question, don't ask me the second half. All right. I didn't even know how I all of a sudden remembered a shir from many, many years ago. Pair of celebrations that happened to be in it. And I decided, then I remembered that it's written up someplace, and I decided that I'm going to go through it again, and I was inspired all over it. I found so many fascinating things. So we're going to try and make our way through this year, and then we'll see where we go from there. On the first sheet, the first side of the sheet, the one that says on it, carbon silver, JCA, Parshas Mishpatim, Election Day, and by the way, the relationship is not only going to be the Parshas Mishpatim, the shir is going to be related indeed to Election Day. And by the end of the shir, I had better make those two connections. The Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin, Daf Zayin Amid Aleph, interrupts a discussion in the Gemara in order to tell us about seven different adages, comments, in Yiddish most probably it's a sprechwort, that the common folk would say. Now, there are certain adages that go from generation to generation, sort of, you know, sounds very simple. And here, these seven statements of common folk. Shmuel, one of the great, great rabbis of the Talmud, who was the head of the seminary in Neher Doi, in Babel, finds a source in Tanakh to each one of these folk statements. There's a seventh one that Rabbi Avuhu finds the source for. What's the point of taking something that's said by the man in the street and relating it to a pasuk in Tanakh? You'll see the statements and you'll see what the Gemara is going to say. It's very strange. Second of all, what's it doing in the middle of a Gemara? Plunked in the middle of a sugi in the Gemara that's dealing with the question of the relationship between din and pshah. People come to a court. The court has the right, with the agreement of the people who come, to ask psak halacha. They have a choice of asking for din. We want the letter of the law. But then there's another possibility. That other possibility is pshara. Pshara means compromise between the two sides. Reuven and Shimon have a dispute over money, over land, over something. So it is the Beis Din may very well decide Reuven is right and Shimon is wrong. Or there's the possibility of finding some kind of an even ground between the two. Negotiation and compromise. And the Gemara wants to know, is pshara a good thing or is pshara a bad thing? And there are two opinions in the Gemara. One says no, din, the letter of the law. Then there's another that says, and therefore pshara is unacceptable. Because pshara is already moving out of the realm of clear halach. When one passes din, then they take a look at the situation in front of them, they find the correct sif or siman in Shulchan Aruch, and then you pass. Pshara already requires all sorts of intuitive, subjective knowledge. Din is always objective. That's it. You cite chapter and verse. You relate it to the situation at present before us. That's it. So the Gemara is talking about the merits of pshara. Those who one who says pshara is not a good thing, and the other who says pshara is a good thing. Then the Gemara comes with the following seven adages. So just sit back and we'll learn a piece of Gemara. We're going to learn a piece of Gemara. Where it says number one on the sheet, Ahuda have a ka'amar va'azim. These four words introduce each one of the seven adages. Hahu, there was this man, the Havaka Omar, who walked along, said, Vazla, as he walked along. In other words, when they mean walked along, what the Gemara means is, and it's the kind of thing that you'll hear people say. And you know what he said? First statement is, Tuvei deshama va'adish. You see, they spoke in Aramaic. That's the man in the street. Tuve, it's better to shama that one hears va'adish and doesn't respond. Tuve de shama va'adish. Fortunate is one who hears his own denigration without responding and becomes accustomed to this. Cholfuha bishtameya. By being able to listen to yourself being denigrated and insulted, you know what you do? 100 tzadas pass you by. You remain silent, 100 tzadas pass you by. You're going to get involved in all sorts of, I wanted to say that, before you know it, there's going to be a give and take, and it's going to become a terrible, terrible process. Very often it's just best to pay no attention, let it roll off your back. So then, Omalei Shmuel, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shmuel said to Rabbi Yehuda, Koksir, this is a pasuk. It's important to Shmuel to say that this common folk wisdom is a pasuk. What's the pasuk? Poter manim reishis madol. By the way, one of the relationships is because the Gemara, when it talked about Din and Pshara, had just earlier in the Gemara quoted the pasuk in Mishlei, Poter Mayim Reishis Madon. Poter Mayim means the one who opens up the dam and the water starts rushing out. Reishis, that's the beginning of Madon, of all sorts of legal problems. And the Gemara goes in further and says, Reishis Madon, they read the word Madon as Meyodin. 100 different problems come when the floodgates are open. And the floodgates we're talking about is somebody says something. Somebody says something that can open up, a Pandora's box, or it opens up the floodgates of water coming out, and then you end up with such problems that you never get out of it. So Shmuel said, that's what the pasuk says. Poter mayim reishis madon. This is written in a verse. Releasing water is the beginning of strife. And they say madon. They read the word madon as meaning reish meyodina, the beginning of 100 misfortunes. Okay. Let's go. How would have a comma of awesome? It was a person who went along and he said, Atarti klaz ganava lo mikto. For two or three thefts, a thief is not killed. Amalei Shmuel Rabbi Yehuda. I mean, obviously what he means by this is that retribution does not necessarily come swiftly. There are people who may get away with crime, certainly for a certain period of time. I don't know if crime pays, I'm not saying crime pays, but you can get away with it. But ultimately what this folk adage is saying, the criminal is going to get it. But our class ganover, two or three thefts, person doesn't get killed. Only Shmuel Rav Yehuda. Shmuel said to Rav Yehuda, crux of it's a pasuk. Pasuk in Amos. Karmar Hashem, so says God, for three sins of Israel I may not punish, but for the fourth lo ashivenu, I will not turn away from punishing. Number three, you'll get the swing of it. Hahu, the havakom of Oslo. Again, here is a man who's walking along and he says, Shev bidi l'shalmona. Shev is seven in Aramaic. Bidi is a bore, a pit. L'shalmona, a man who is shalem, a good person. There can be seven pits for the good person or the man of peace, but he's saved from all of them. V'chodol ovid bish. And then there's one pit in which the fellow who does evil falls. Only Shmuel Rav Yehuda, again, Shmuel says to Rav Yehuda, crocs it. Same thing. There's a pasuk that says this. Ki shev adipol tzadik v'kom. The tzadik will fall seven times, but he's going to get up after each fall. V'chosho yipol barachas, but the chosho falls in one. I mean, there's in each case, there has to be a meaning beyond the simple folk adage. It means the Rosha falls into despair and then he's lost. The man of peace or the tzaddik never falls into despair. He can fall and rise again. Fall and rise again. Number four. Who the Havakama of Oslo, a person, was this man who walked along saying, the Oslo Beidina, Shak Agalima. One who leaves court, the Ozalmi Beit Dina, he went out of Beis Din, under the court, and they took his coat away so he should be able to pay what he owes. Beis Din found him guilty, and he has to pay. I don't know if you ever listen, or maybe you never hear the mumbling of the Tabak under a chuppah, when they read the Ksuba, so this time listen in more carefully, where the chosn, husband, commits himself that he's going to pay the ksuba afilu mil glima de al kat poi, even from the coat that's upon my shoulders. If that's what I have to give the glima, so listen for that. You shouldn't always just think that you can't understand the ksuba. Afilu mil glima de al kat poi. I'm ready to pay even from the coat upon my shoulders. So here it is, a man who comes out of Beit Din after they have removed his coat in order to pay. Lizmar Zemer V'Lezul Be'urcha. He should sing a happy song and go on his way. Lizmar Zemer V'Lezul Be'urcha. Let him go on his road, but sing a happy song, you understand? They should be full of joy. Amalei Shmuel Rav Yehuda, Shmuel Seth Rav Yehuda, Kroksiv. Pasuk says, V'gam kol ha'om hazeh al mekomo yavo b'shalom. That was last week's sedra. Yitro tells Moshe, if you can have a system of judges so that everybody has somebody to turn to, so not only will it lighten the burden from you, but this whole people will be able to go about their business in peace because they will have a court to come to bring their disputes. And when they go out of court, it means even if they're found guilty, Sing a happy song. And obviously what the adage is, at first it might hurt, but then afterwards you're going to think to yourself, listen, if the court said that I owe this money, thank God I paid it. Doesn't somebody feel good when if you have a loan and you finally pay it back, you feel terrific. Or you have any kind of responsibility or burden and you carry it out, you execute it, you did it. You feel good. All right. Number five. Ahud Avakom of Oslo. There was a person who walked along saying, Hinaima v'dikulo shofil. Hinaima. Naima means sleeping. Lo yonum. It's similar. Aramaic is similar to Hebrew. Lo yonum v'lo yishon shomer Yisrael. The guardian of Israel neither sleeps nor slumbers. He's talking about a woman who has a basket on her head. What happens if she falls asleep but she has the basket on her head? There goes the basket and all of its contents is going to fall out all over the place and going to be lost. He naima, when a woman sleeps, the basket perched on her head lowers. And yes, it means when a person is lazy, the quality of his handiwork suffers. Only Shmuel or Rabbi Yehuda. Here again, the same pattern. Shmuel says to Rabbi Yehuda. And Shmuel, remember, great rabbi. And he finds that there's something significant about this folk adage. And he says it's a pasuk. Ba'atzaltayim yimacha mekore. It's a pasuk in Kohelet that says ba'atzaltayim, because of slothfulness. Through laziness. Oh, they use the word slothfulness. I thought I was making up that word. Okay. Like, it's not the kind of word I use in daily conversation. Because of laziness, yimach hamekore, the ceiling. You know, you have a little bit of retivot and you don't do anything about it. Then you have a little more retivot and you still do nothing. Then you see the ads in the Jerusalem Post by calling Mr. Retivot, and you tell yourself you're going to call him, then you forget to call him. And then you know what? Then shtikah start falling from the roof. Ba'atzaltayim, because of laziness, yimach hamekore. So that's what he's talking about. This folk adage, she falls asleep, and the basket just falls off ahead. Number six. Ahuda ha'vakam ha'vazel. There was this man who walked along saying, Gavna derachitzna alei. The man upon whom I depended, Gavra the Rechitznale, the man upon whom I depended, the one I trusted, Adil Gazizeh come, raised his fists and stood against me. Adil Gazizeh come. Here I depended on somebody, I trusted somebody, and he turned out to be my enemy. Rechitzna. Where do you have that word? Bela, I thought we made up that you wouldn't answer the questions that were prepared. No, we didn't. Bei anorochitz. What we say when the Sefer Torah is taken out is Bei anorochitz. I depend and I trust God. Lo al bar Elohim rochitzna. I don't depend or trust or place my faith in Bar Elohim, any kind of angel. Bei anorachitz. V'lishmei kadisha yakira, to his precious name, I praise. Bei anorachitz. So here it says, here's a common folk wisdom. The one whom I depended upon is the one who came up and he struck me. So Shmuel, all of the Shmuel, Rabbi Yehuda, Shmuel, Sefer Rabbi Yehuda, Kroksiv, it's a pasuk. Gam ish shlomi asher botachti bo, it's a pasuk in Tehillim. The man of my peace, asher botachti bo, whom I trusted in, higdil olai okev. He turned around against me. The seventh. Oh, really? Moving ahead. Okay. This is the seventh and the last. And this is not going to be Shmuel anymore. This is going to be Rabbi Rahuna. Rahuna, I'm sorry. All right. There was this man who walked along saying, Ki rechimten hava aziza, when our love was strong, aputya desafsido shechivan, we could lie on the edge of a sword. When our love was great, we could lie together on the edge of a sword. Hashte delo azizi lechimton. Now that our love is not that strong, purya barshitin garmidi lo segelo. A purya is a bed. A bed that's 60 cubits wide, lo segelo, is not enough for us. You should give some thought to... this one? Okay. I didn't remember what I said. Okay. So try to remember how we're going to explain this in terms of a lesson for life. Omar Rahuna says, Kroiksivi, it's a pasuk. And here it's already not one pasuk. It's Psukim say it. Mikoriksiv at first it says, and this is going to be, I believe, in next week's Sedra. So you see, we're skirting. We've already had a pasuk from last week's Sedra in Yisro. Now we have one from Truma. God says, "V'no aditi l'cha, I'm going to appear to you and I'm going to appear to you, Shamba Dibarti and Chom Yara Kaporet, and I will speak with you from above the covering of the ark. From the ark in the Mishkan. The Dibarti and Chom Yara Vetanya, and we learn the Braisa. Braisa is a statement there. The statement of the Tanaim, the first generation, first few generations of the scholars of the Talmud were the Tanaim. Those were till and after the destruction of the Second Temple. They said the Mishnah, the Braita, and the Tosefta. The Talmud Bavli already are the Amoraim of Bavel, which come from the beginning of the 3rd century and further. The time we learned Oron Tisha Kaporas Tefa, the Oron, the ark was 9 Tvachim high, and the covering, the Kaporak on top of it was 1 Tefa. Harei Kanasara, so you have a total of 10. So when the love between God and his people was strong, God's presence rested on the covering of the ark, which was only 10 Tvachim from the ground. This height, that's all. The whole thing was this height. Uksidin, it says, when Shlomo HaMelech built the. Bet HaMikdash v'Habayit Hashem Bona Abel Shlomo L'Hashem Shishim Amo Orko V'Shish V'Esrim Rachbo U'Shloshim Amo Komato. The house that King Solomon built was 60 amos in length, 20 in width, and 30 high. L'Psof Kativ. So in other words, we're moving. God's presence appears to us in the Mishkan in Parashat Truma from the little Aron. Aron was this size. In the days of Shlomo, we need a great deal. Bigger amount of space, and then ultimately it says at the end of Sefer Yeshayahu, Omar Hashem, so says God, Hashemayim Kisi, the heaven is my throne, Va'aretz Hakon Raglai, and the earth is my footstool. Ezeh Bayit Asher Tivnu Li, what kind of house can you build for me? There is no house that you can build for me. And here we started with a little house that was the Mishkan, the little house in the desert. And then we came to the bigger house on the Temple Mount. And then ultimately God says, well, what is there that you can build for me? Now, when love was great, and the relationship between God and the Jewish people was strong, that little Aron was enough. And as we moved away from God, we needed a great deal. We had to give each other space. We weren't able to come together in one small gathering. Okay. These are the 7 adages in the Gemara. And for each one of them, the rabbis of the Talmud, specifically Shmuel and Rav Huna, found some kind of a source for it in Tanakh. So, number one, why was it important to find a source in Tanakh? And what was the meaning of finding a source of Tanakh? Why did he even bother? And furthermore, the other question that we ask is, what is this Gemara doing in the middle of a section of the Talmud that's dealing with an extremely significant issue? Is Torah and Halacha for compromise and pshara in disputes between people and nations? Or is Torah opposed to pshara? In order to begin to understand that, we have to learn another Gemara. The other Gemara is on the other side. This Gemara on the other side is one that the Rav used to quote often. It was something upon which we will see he based many of his approaches, and I'm going to use this particular Gemara and the Rav's approach to explain another din in Shulchan Aruch that is of great contemporary significance. That's going to be my contribution to this discussion. The Gemara at the end of the 3rd Perek, the 3rd chapter of Masechet Nida, says the following. It describes the embryo in the womb of a mother. What does the embryo do for 9 months? What do you do for 9 months? The Gemara is going to tell us that the best time in a person's life are those 9 months. Those 9 months. It's just an idyllic existence. And the Gemara says, throughout one's life on earth, there are no days during which a person experiences more bliss than during the days in his mother's womb. Shenema, it says, Minitneini ki yarchi kedem. Eo says, oh, if only I would be able to go, you know, the good old days. If only I could go back to yarchi kedem. Yarchi kedem means days of old, but the word yerach also has another meaning. Yerach means a month. When is one's life counted in months? In the womb. Oh, if only I can go back to those days. B'nei Elokai Yishmereni, at the time when God is the one who watches over me. Oh, who would give me a life like the months of yore, like the days when God watched over me? V'eza yom sheyesh bem yirachim ve'en bem shanim. When are there days in a person's life that are counted by months and not by years? So he says, of course, have yomer, you must say that these are yarchei leida. Yarchei leida. Where do you have the term yarchei leida? Echad miyodeya. Tisha miyodeya. Tisha yarchei leida. The 9 months that it takes for a child to be born. Now comes the famous Gemara that you all know it all, but now we have to get down to understanding what does it indeed mean. The Braisa resumes its account of the in utero experience of the embryo, Umilandin Oto Kola Torah Kula. He's very, very busy in the womb. Not a dull moment. They teach him all of Torah. There's a Malach who teaches him all of Torah. Shenema, as it says, Vayoreini, he taught me, Vayomeli, and he said to me, Yitmot Devorai Libichos Shemor Mitzotai Chayeh, let your heart cling to my words, observe my commandments, and live. Va'omer, and it says, Besod Elokai, when the company of God, Alei Ohali, was above my tent. When am I in the company of God and not in the company of anybody else? The only time you're in the company of God alone. You know, in this world we have to tolerate other human beings, but in the womb there's only God. All right, we can go on to the next column. The Kibon Shebola Avid Ha'olam. As soon as the child emerges into the air of the world, Bo Malach V'Sofro Al Piv, along comes an angel and strikes him on his mouth, Umishakho Kol HaTorah Kula, and makes him forget all the Torah that he learned in the womb. Shenem, as it says, Lapetach Chatat Ravetz. And that's a pasuk by God says to Kayin. And here the Gemara is interpreting it as meaning Lapetach, when you come out to the opening, out into this world, their sin lies in waiting. And then the rest of the Gemara is significant because one of the great svarim of Jewish Hashkafa, of Hashkafa, begins with this. He doesn't go out of the womb until an oath is administered. And down at the bottom it says, what's the oath? What oath is administered to the womb, to the child, the embryo in the womb? Be tzaddik and don't be rasha. Even if the whole world tells you you're a tzaddik, in your own eyes you should see yourself as a rasha and that you have so much more to accomplish. This last piece of Gemara is the very opening statement of the Tanya, the great Sefer of Chassidut that was written by the Baal HaTanya, Rav Shneur Zalman Miladi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. It begins, Tanya, Sef Perek Gimel de Nida, we learned at the end of the third Perek of Nida, Majibir Nisadam Ti Tzadik, Al Ti Rasha, an oath is administered to the child before it comes out that it should be Tzadik and not be Rasha. In my youth, oh, this was a long time ago. I was closeted away in the women's section of a shtiebel in Williamsburg. It was called the Polish Shtiebel. And somebody was teaching me Tanya. His name was Shlomo Kalbach. I was about 15, 16, and he must have been about 10 years older than me. Remember, I'll never forget the first year time that we learned Seif Perek Gimel de Nida, at the end of the third Perek of Nida, so they even interpret this as meaning. So remember, he said Nida is Isha, Isha is Klal Yisrael, Seif Perek Gimel is the end of the third return of Jews to well, the time of Mashiach is coming in the first time, coming the second time, coming the third time. When that arrival in Eretz Yisrael comes to its end, that means the Gaul is on the way. I should be in this Adam team, sadly, about the Rasha, you understand? That was a great, okay. Well, that's about all I remember from 15 years old, I was okay. What we really have to get down to is, what is, here we have another problem. Why teach the embryo all of Torah if all you're going to do is make him forget it when he comes out? What's the point? It was an exercise in futility. Poor kid has to go through Kol HaTorah Kula, and then, as he's coming out into the world, a patch and torn him, and he forgets it all. What was the point? What does it mean? So we have a lot of things we don't understand. So we better get down to understanding what it means. So the Rav used this very often in order to say, yes, it's true. It's true that the child doesn't remember any Torah. But you know what has been implanted in the genes, in the subconscious? There's a sense of what's fair, what's right, what's just, what's holy. The neshama already is revolted by evil. You may never be conscious of it, but it's there in the neshama of every child that's born. There is a basic sense of decency, a sense of what's true, what's good, what's evil, what's wrong, what's right. And the fact is that this very simple yet profound idea expresses itself in so many ways. One of the ways in which it expresses itself is in this Gemara. Shmuel had a great deal of respect for the common folk wisdom of a Jew living in Herdor. If a Jew is saying something, this is a sprechwort, so to speak, that is being said by people, it doesn't come from air. It comes from a deep sense of this sanctity that is infused within the womb. There's no such thing as a pusher to lead or a nothing Jew. Every Jew went through that tremendous experience in the womb. And therefore, emerging with that, even if one is unlearned, unlearned meaning, yes, technical matters he may not understand, he may not be able to paskin halacha because he doesn't know Torah. But because he doesn't know Torah, it doesn't mean that he doesn't have an inner, profound and dynamic sense of what's good and what's evil. And therefore, if you hear people saying something, by the way, I'll say that everything here has to be understood in context. I'm not talking necessarily about the Jew who's been raised in a completely non-religious and non-observant society and has already had who knows how many layers of Western decadent culture, or even, I'll tell you, Western decadent culture is not more decadent than ancient decadent culture. It's all been decadent. We're talking about a Pasha Tegin. Goes to Davin in the morning, maybe says a few kapitachilim, can't learn a Gemara to save himself, never opened up a chandam. But he's in the milieu. He's in the atmosphere. And in that atmosphere, he has the ability to, that great wisdom comes from, great wisdom can come from him. And Shmuel wants to point that out. Shmuel, you hear people saying something, don't simply dismiss it. Oh no, it's not to be dismissed. There's Torah in this. And you know where this Torah comes from? This Torah comes from the experience with the angel in the womb of the mother during all of those 9 months. It's not wasted time. Not wasted time. And even if the Malach doesn't show up on an ultrasound, believe me, he's there. That's what the Torah says. So therefore, we're talking about the whole idea that great rabbis have equally great respect for common folk is a very, very important contribution to our understanding of Kol Yisrael. It also means another thing. It means that the demands that Torah make upon the Jew are not foreign to his nature. it's not as though Torah is imposing upon the Jew something that he's simply incapable of living up to. Especially when we're talking about one of the prime mitzvahs in Torah, which is v'halachta b'drachav, you should go in the ways of God. You should emulate God just as He is merciful. You be merciful. He's compassionate. You be compassionate. Just as God is truth, you should be truth. Don't for a moment think that these are ideas or goals that are beyond your ability to achieve. No, it's not so. Because you've been there before, and it left an impression on the neshama, and it can express itself in all of these ways. The Rav, very often, and this is always important, you hear about a custom. And there are customs that leave you with the impression like this is a little silly, it's spook stuff, I don't understand what this is all about. We never did this at home. Reserve judgment. A minhag, a custom, it comes from Jews, then you have to know that somewhere, there's something meaningful there and something significant. Certainly up until this generation, we were not a foolish people. I have my doubts about this generation, but I'll wait till 10 o'clock tonight. A minhag comes from something that has great meaning and great significance. So you have to be careful. Never judge hastily, like, you know, because we didn't do it by us in the Haim, then it has to be something that has no meaning to it. You have to be very careful. I've always appreciated, therefore, the Orach HaShulchan. We're going to see an Orach HaShulchan right away. The Orach HaShulchan always attempts to find a source for a Jewish custom. It doesn't come from the air. We're not, by nature, we are not a foolish people. And if we do act foolishly, it's only the result of forces from without, not from within. Because from within, we all had the session with the Malach. We all had the session with the Malach. And by the way, the session with the Malach is for boys and for girls. I don't know if there are female Malachim, but of course there are. I would say so. I'm ready to buy that. Michaela, Gabriela, yes. Whatever they are, they must. Everybody shares in that. Here on this back side of the page, there are two halachas. There are two halachas from the Rambam. Number three is the halacha, famous halacha. In Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam says, "Kol anaviyim kulam tzivu ala tshuva." All the prophets commanded that Jews should do tshuva. Ve'ein Yisrael nigol in el b'tshuva, and Israel ultimately will be redeemed only through repentance. And listen to the next sentence: "Ukvar hivticha Torah." Torah has already promised and guaranteed. Shesov Yisrael lasos tshuva b'sov galutam. The end is that Israel will do tshuva at the end of their exile. Umiyad heim nigolin, and immediately they're going to be redeemed. How can Torah promise that? Tshuva is something that depends on free will. How can Torah make a guarantee? How can Torah make a guarantee that Tommy Lapid is going to learn in Arsameach and Yossi Sarid is going to be in Eish HaTorah? You understand? Huh? There is God yet. Oh, he said there was a God, but he during the night, that night in 96, he must probably change his mind. When they thought that, at 10 o'clock, when they thought that Peres was elected prime minister, so he said, "Yosh Elohim, there's a God." So, but he disappeared about 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. Right, see what he has to say now. How is the Yivticha Torah? How can Torah guarantee that Jews are ultimately going to do tshuva? So the Rav says, you know, Torah can guarantee, because ultimately we're going to return to that utero condition. We're going to return to a society that is going to enforce all the sanctity and the holiness and the goodness that we imbibed into our genes from the Malach in the course of being in the womb. There's another major halach, number four. I'll just tell you this. You know, I'm afraid I may not have enough time to say everything I have to say. This is an unbelievable halach. The halach says the following: there are certain conditions under pain forces a husband to give his wife a divorce. And the halacha expresses it as kofin oto, you coerce him, ad sheyomar, until he says, rotze ani, I want. Now, have you ever heard a sentence that seems to be so clearly in contradiction of itself? Kofin oto, you coerce him until he says, rotze ani, I want. Because the halacha is, a person cannot, a get that's given by a husband against his free will is not valid. That's always been the halachic difficulty with, you know, New York state laws coercing somebody to give a get. Coercion is prohibited. There has to be a free decision taken to begin to give a get. But here the Gemara says that there are certain circumstances, such as that law, certain circumstances, where we force him until he says yes. What do you mean you force him until he says yes? So this is an amazing Rambam that really needs a tremendous amount of study. It's a great Rambam. But the Rambam says that deep down, every Jew wants to do the right thing. In his neshama, he wants to do the right thing. The only thing is, there are all sorts of layers that are covering up that good neshama. And a person, his yetzer hara is in the way. You beat him. And every time you beat him, you get rid of the yetzer hara. You remove all of the layers of evil. And do you know what remains at the end? Pristine, natural Jew. And when he says, Rotzani, I want to give the get, that's coming from the real, honest depths of his neshama. What an unbelievable halacha. So the Chov explained that this halacha is obviously based on the fact that at the core, every Jew sat and learned with a malach. Learned with a malach. Now I'll tell you where I'm taking it. On the first side, it says Dvarim Shebnei Ha'ir. If you'll see on the right hand side, that's from Shulchan Aruch Choshen Mishpat. Dvarim Shebnei Ha'ir Kofin Zeh. There are things that people of the city can coerce one another to do. I mean, there's a system that runs the Jewish community. Take a look at where it's underlined. It's a little small, but you know, a little effort goes a long way. Kol tzarchei tzibur she'einan yecholim l'hashvot atzman. All of the needs of the community that people simply can't agree upon. They can't agree. Yesh v'hoshiv kol balavayit. You have to get together all of the members of the community. Hanotnim mas, those who pay taxes. Every Jewish community had a system of internal taxation. Because the Shulchan Aruch, for example, in Or HaChaim, this is Chosh Mishpat, in Or HaChaim it says that the members of the community can coerce one another to build a shul, to build a mikveh, to engage a rabbi, to have a chazan, to buy Sifrei Torah, Sifrei Haftarah. There are all sorts of community needs. And community needs are such that the whole community has to participate in it. And if there are people who don't want to participate, the community has a right and the power to coerce. So now what happens if they come to a problem that they can't agree on? So you're supposed to take all of the dues-paying members of the community. Listen to this next sentence. They have to accept upon themselves, shekol echod yomar dato l'shem shamayim, that each one is going to express his opinion l'shem shamayim, for God's sake. V'yelchu achar harov, and you go according to the majority. If you want to know democracy in Torah, this is classic. So first of all, it says you have to get every dues-paying member together, and everybody should express their opinion, but they have to express their opinion l'shem shamayim. In other words, one cannot have any personal interest over here, but what he truly believes, that's what he's supposed to say. We will see also that there was a chedem, or a curse placed. A curse was placed You better say what you have to say and say it with Shel Shamayim. But don't, you know, it cannot be as the result of a payoff. It's not because you're a Kaplan who wants to be able to build another 500 stories more than the one story that's permitted according to law. It's not because you're looking for all sorts of, political or other favors. You have to look at the issue and look at the issue squarely, and you have to come to a real, real conclusion. And then he says, you go according to the rove, the majority. V'im hamiut yimanu, and if the minority who lose the vote refuse to participate. In other words, if the rove decided that, listen, we have to build a mikveh and it's therefore going to cost $500 to each family, and the ones who didn't vote for it say, I'm sorry, I didn't vote for it, I'm opposed to it. So you know what the Shulchan Aruch says? You can even take them to Goyish court. The community is able to take them to Goyish court in order to coerce them. You can't break the rules of the community. So it says, and if the minority refuse, the majority can coerce them, even through the courts of non-Jews. You have the right to spend community money in order to take it to court, and for lawyers and all sorts of other things. The minority has to join the majority. They have to give their share. The hamisarev milomar dato al pi hacheder, the person who refuses to express his opinion, he doesn't want to go vote. I'm not voting. And there's been a ban of excommunication on somebody who doesn't express his opinion. The tailor dato, he doesn't count. He's out of the game. We go according to the rest who remain, who are expressing their opinion. Somebody who doesn't express his opinion doesn't count. That's it. We're not going to say that, you know, there are those who refuse to vote, and listen, 50% of the country didn't go to vote. So how can you pierce anything on the basis of the fact that only 50% went to vote? What happens if 60% of the country didn't go to vote and 40 did? How can the 40, even if all of them would vote for the same candidate, there's still a majority that didn't go to vote. Anybody who doesn't go to vote doesn't count. You're out of it. You're out of the game altogether. Here is a classic statement of halacha. But then I have a problem. Why should it be so? Why should it be so? You know why should it be so? Because halacha has respect for the innate feeling of the Jew. Because a malach learned with him. This is another halacha. So then you can ask me. I know what you can ask me. But Nebuch. A lot of people don't really know how to vote or what to vote for. That's my opinion. Yes, I understand. But we know the truth. We know the truth. A lot of people don't know. I mean, a lot of people are going to make a terrible mistake today. A lot of people should better stay home. So that's why I made it very clear. When Shmuel was taking folk wisdom and he was raising it to the level of Torah, he's talking about folk wisdom that emerges from a community that is suffused with Yiddishkeit. And if there are any problems that we have, It is certainly the result of 2,000 years of Golos, and it's also the result of the fact that so many of our people are overwhelmed, submerged by a dominant world society that impacts on us. If we could scrape away all of the layers, we'd find a tired Yiddish neshama. In so many of our people, and most probably in moments of great crisis, it will come to the surface. But it means, number one, democracy is a basic part of halacha, because Klal Yisrael has respect for the common Jew. And maybe the word common isn't a good word to use, because every so-called common Jew has an uncommon neshama. That's what it's all about. Now you know why I was learning this on election day. And you don't have to wait till the end of the shiur to ask me what it has to do with Parshas Mishpatim. Simply, the center of Parshas Mishpatim is Acharei Rabim Lahatot. This is the pasuk. You go according to the majority. It's a pasuk in the center. The center says you follow majority vote. Parenthetic comment that I'm afraid to make, but I think I have to make it. And please don't misunderstand me. You certainly will. It doesn't make any difference. Why doesn't the Shulchan Aruch simply say, let's get a psak halacha from Gedolei Yisrael how to vote? Why don't we get a psak halacha from Das Torah, Gedolei Yisrael? And therefore, every poor schnook who has to go vote will have absolutely no problem. It's not what the Shulchan Aruch wants. We want the da'at, the opinion of each person, his opinion, da'ato, l'shem shemayim, not an opinion that is decided upon from above. We want to hear what you have to say. You have a Yiddish neshama, you had a malach, I want to hear what do you have to say. So the idea that when people tell me, well, I have no problem what to do, my God will tell me what to do, I think that that's absolutely opposed. That's absolutely opposed to what the Shulchan Aruch is saying. We want your opinion. And you have to give us your opinion, l'shem shemayim. And if it's not your opinion, we're not interested in it. We're not interested in it. You have to listen to the pros and cons, and your neshama, we want to know what your neshama has to say about it. I may very well be tarred and feathered by the time I get back to Har Nof. May very well get tarred and feathered, but that's clearly what Shulchan Aruch is saying. Shulchan Aruch has much greater respect for the common Jew than the common Jew may have for himself. I can't make such a decision. I need... Now, of course, if it's your rabbi who tells you to vote for Maftal, that's a completely different story. By the way, I always say, I spoke Friday night in shul, and I always say, I'm telling you what I'm going to do and why I'm going to do it. I never have ever said, do such and such. Even though I got a call from a member of my family in an absolute, she was in such a tears. Who should I vote for? So I told her who to vote for. And she's going to do exactly that. I think Magdal should give me a medal. I got one more vote for her. Yes?
Just for clarity, the Agos that were underlined, who was the author and what year? Because I think it's phenomenal.
Oh, that'll be a whole shit. This is going back to Rav Moshe Iselish. Rav Moshe Iselish takes us back about 400 years. And when he's writing it 400 years ago, you know what he's really saying? That was the practice already in Jewish communities for 1,000 years.
So this is about
1600. Oh, yeah, but you hear what I'm saying? Okay. When he writes it in the 1600s, he's not coming along all of a sudden to tell us, you know, I'm discovering America. There's democracy in Kleinesau. He is telling us what the practice was in every Jewish community, and every Jewish community had elections. And they voted on, well, it's no different than our shul. Our shuls. You get together, we need to build a new shul. There isn't enough place. So you always know how it works. The guys that have no money are the ones who say, we can do it. The accountants always are opposed to expansion and construction because they have to have everything figured out to the last penny, and there's no way you ever figure out anything in a Jewish community to the last penny. You always have to take the leap of faith, a leap of faith. I remember once I had a president who was an accountant, and a vote to build the new shul passed with one vote. And he says, I don't have the backing of the community behind me. I can't do it. And I've worked it out, pencil and paper, it's just not going to work. Tell him, listen, just listen to me. I was a young guy then, I was pretty young. I told him, listen, it passed. Let's give it a chance. A year later, the building was finished, you understand? And not only finished, it was paid for without a mortgage. And and he wasn't the only accountant, there were a few accountants. The accountants were the guys who always said no. And it was done. You know, people get involved in the excitement and the midst of building a new shul. All sorts of things can happen. The same thing is true about any great undertaking of the Jewish community. All right, so the point that I want to make is that this halacha in Shulchan Aruch is based on the idea of great respect of each and every individual Jew. Because, as the Rav says, there's a malach who learned with him, and therefore it's in his neshama. It's in his neshama. Well, we have, there's so little time left, but let's go one step further. Maybe the rest I can leave I can leave for your own for you to think about. These seven statements that our rabbis over here wanted to find some source in Tanakh. First of all, we had asked, what is its meaning in the context of the Gemara? Now we understand the meaning in the context of the Gemara is beautiful. The Gemara is talking about whether compromise is good. Can you use a compromise? Instead of paskening the din, what about pshara? What's the difference between din and pshara? For din, you can cite chapter and verse. Pshara, where does pshara come from? On what basis does a judge or do judges arrive at some kind of a compromise? How? What is it? They can't cite chapter and verse. You know what it comes from? An inner sense of what would be fair to both sides. How do I know that the inner sense of what's fair to both sides is something that is valid in halacha? So the Gemara brings the seven stories to show how Chachmei Yisrael took a look at that wisdom that comes deep from within the wellsprings of a human being's neshama. That there is a truth to pshara, because pshara has something on which it's based. It's not chapter and verse, but you know what it is? A pristine, natural, holy neshama that learned with a malach. And there's something inside that just gives us a sense of what's fair, what's good, what's right. That's why pshara can work. And therefore the Gemara is going to end up by saying that the psak halacha is, you can go for pshara. And very often, by the way, not very often, every time two litigants will come to a Beis Din, the first question that is asked, do you want din or do you want pshara? And then most probably the Rav or the Rabbanim will attempt to convince them that maybe pshara is the best way to go. And then you end up listening to both sides, you find some common ground in the middle, and that's it. In other words, pshara means that there are no losers and there are no winners. Everybody's a half loser and everybody's a half winner. Din is always looking for one absolute eizer loser and eizer winner. And it's not always like that in life. Because many disputes are not completely that black and white. There's a gray area. And the gray area is pshara. And the gray area of pshara works because an neshama is the sign of that pshara. One major part that is yet left to discuss over here is the following, these seven. And maybe we'll only take one just to show you an example. These seven folk wisdoms were not simple folk wisdom. They have profound meaning for Klal Yisrael. For example, the first one was that a person who hears his abuse and is able to remain silent is avoiding 100 causes of strife. So the Rav in the Shia said, the strength of Klal Yisrael to survive throughout history is the fact that we were able to listen to our abuse and not pay attention. If we would have paid attention to every crumb of abuse that has been thrown at us, and we have received and continue to receive daily more than any other people on the face of this earth. We are the object of abuse. If we would take it seriously, we would have disappeared a long time ago. The only reason why we don't disappear is Hartmann-Gesuch, so they said, so what? They tell us we kill babies before Pesach in order to have blood. You know, they say all sorts of things about us. They tell us that we're occupiers. They tell us that we kill innocent civilians. How many did America kill in Afghanistan? 8,000, 9,000? We didn't enough 500 years to kill as many civilians as they did. Doesn't make any difference. There's a whole different standard for us. And the ability to climb yourself to survive is that we can listen to all of this abuse and just go about our daily activities. The idea that a person is not punished for, is not killed for two or three thefts, four or more, it is a message to climb the soil. Ultimately, evil will be vanquished. Maybe it's not quick enough for us, but you should know, make no mistake, the day of judgment comes, and all those who've caused us suffering are going to pay and pay very, very dearly for it. Here's another beautiful one. There are seven pits for the righteous. They fall and they get up, and the Russia falls into one of these. The idea is simple, yet it's profound. The idea is the Jew does not know the meaning of despair. We don't give up. If we would despair, we would have disappeared. But we don't despair. Other nations, mighty and stronger than us, fell into despair and they couldn't pick themselves up again. But the tzaddik, Sheva, he can fall seven times and he gets up and he keeps going. And the Russia is going to come to his one defeat, and then he's finished for all time. Doesn't get up again. Each one of the adages in the Gemara is talking about something that's significant to us as a people and to us as individuals. Either we have to talk about that last one, when our love was great, we were able to sleep on the edge of a sword, and now that love is not that strong, we need a bed, you know, as big as who knows what. I have a feeling that the way I understand it, or what I, there may be many meanings to it, but the way I understand it is, here's something we just heard about somebody, they're living in the States, wife wants very much to come on Aliyah, and the husband says he can't leave his comforts. Okay. His comforts. He can't give up his comforts. Now, I don't know, for those of us living here, that sounds a little shallow, I would say, a little shallow. What happens if there would be great idealism? What happens if he would be idealistic about the idea of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, about living in Eretz Yisrael, being part of the great adventure that is Eretz Yisrael? His comforts would mean nothing. The ideal is that which would move him. When the love was great, when idealism was there, then we didn't need much. But Jews have lived through so much in this country. Even when I came the first time to learn, there was still rationing. Now, I think two eggs a week and about 3 ounces of meat. Most probably they were healthier then because of that too. But they were living on rationing. Can you imagine an American Jew today coming to a country that's rationing 3 eggs a week? What are you talking about? That's not enough cholesterol to kill anybody. And sometimes you hear things that to people seem very intelligent, but to us, I mean, you think, I mean, I always say it, you think it's easy, you know that it's not terribly easy living here. Remember the last time before as the Gulf War was about to begin, so my wife was talking to some mishpucha out in Chutz concerns. He says, so when are you bringing the family? You understand, the children and the in-law children. We have to bring the in-law children too, you understand? And the 8 o'clock, you know, we're going to pack everybody up, and we're all pulling out, and we're going to Toronto. Doesn't understand what it means. They are Jews, what's wrong with that man thing? We should go in, you know. We're going to a wedding. We have a family wedding in Toronto. And my wife told, family, you know, if they